Well, there's two things that can be said for Ecuador. One of them is that they're offering haven to my friend Mr. Assange, and the other is, as I was reminding you earlier, that the first successful case enforcing rights of nature, as outlined in the 2000 Ecuadorian constitution, involved a river suing the government and doing so successfully. Earth jurisprudence, we've discussed it before, but my next guest has practiced, taught and written about environmental law and policy since way back in 1992. Cormac Cullen is the director of the South African environmental law firm Cullen and Associates, Inc., and the author of Wild Law, the Manifesto for Earth Justice, and he's on the blower from his home in Cape Town. Welcome, Cormac, to LNL, and I hope you're comparatively safe from drones.
Yes, me too. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Now, you'll be here later this week to speak at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney. Is earth jurisprudence, or what you call wild law, a dangerous idea?
Well, it's a good question because, it's certainly dangerous to the establishment in the sense that I think any good dangerous idea undermines long-held assumptions and destabilizes worldviews and opens up new possibilities. So it's dangerous in that sense, but from my view, from a more objective perspective, it's a much safer idea than the ideas that we are currently using to inform our legal systems.
I like the way you use South Africans' bitter experience of apartheid to make us rethink environmental issues, because you argue that environmental damage is far more insidious form of apartheid than what we saw in your country. How so?
Well, being born a white South African male, I was, during the apartheid years, I was essentially born into the class of the oppressor, if you like, and we were taught, the system taught us that we were the top dogs, that we were superior to everybody else, and that apartheid, the word itself, means separateness, and that the way to increase the well-being of the dominant white elite was to exploit everybody else. And of course, that led us to disaster because we are one community in South Africa, completely independent, interdependent. And I suppose that experience of being an anti-apartheid activist left me with a deep distrust of philosophies based on illusions of separation and superiority.
Well, you make the point that there's a fundamentally misconceived belief that humans are separate from and superior to nature.
Exactly, and I suddenly realized that very same thinking applies to the relationship we've established between ourselves and the rest of nature. When I say we, I mean industrialized societies. So in a sense, all of us who are born into industrialized societies and brought up in those systems are a bit like white South Africans. We believe ourselves to be separate from and superior to the rest of nature and don't recognize that we're wholly part of that community.
Well, of course, people who wish to can find some justification for the myth of human separation in the oldest part of the Old Testament, but you like to focus on the development of the myth via such luminaries as Galileo, Francis Bacon and Isaac Newton.
Yes, I think that, they had their reasons at the time for emphasizing the differences. I mean, I think if you go back to people like Descartes, for example, they were trying to escape an oppressive regime where the church didn't allow very much thinking. And so, he made a big deal of the difference between the spiritual, mental dimension and the physical dimension. And then, Newton and Bacon, the so-called Age of Enlightenment in Europe, it really was a period of great scientific progress, but unfortunately it also marked the rise of the idea that the role of science was to enable us to control nature.
Well, of course, they made the point that the physical world was a complex machine that could be understood by reductionist analysis.
Yes, and the interesting thing is that way of thinking is still the basis on which our legal systems are based, even though the scientists have long abandoned those positions. Most scientists accept the fact that quantum physics, etc., demonstrates very clearly that everything is entangled and interrelated, as does ecology, as does almost every other aspect of science today. but the legal system doesn't. The legal system is still based on these old ideas that we humans are subjects and of these creations of ours called corporations, and everything else is an object on which we act. Everything else is property, therefore exploitation, etc. And as soon as you define something else as an object, it kills relationship. You know, you don't have a relationship between a subject and an object in the way you do between two subjects.
You know, as we talk, Cormac, I suddenly remember, although his name escapes me, the Secretary of the Interior during the Reagan years, who was a great believer and indeed a yearner for Armageddon, and he started advocating the mass drilling, as I'm sure you remember, in national parks, taking the view that we wouldn't need the planet much longer and we could sort of shrug it off like an old overcoat.
Yes, it's an extraordinary idea that you have a belief in a creator God that creates the most incredibly beautiful planet we've discovered in the entire universe, rich with life, and that apparently the creator's plan, according to people like that, is that it all be destroyed by one species. I mean, to me, it just doesn't make any sense.
A very old friend of this program, we've had a troubled relationship, I must say, is James Lovelock, of course, whose Gaia hypothesis to some extent anticipated what we're discussing.
Yes, I must say, he was very influential in my thinking at the early stages. I've also departed from it a little bit in more recent years. I mean, the idea that he's quite happy to accept all the nuclear waste of Britain buried in his garden seems to be slightly improbable to me. But one of the really good things I think about James Lovelock's work, though, is that he drew attention to the fact that we are an inextricable part of the system, and that that the system is even more amazing than we thought. The way it regulates temperature, the way it regulates life, regulates the composition of the atmosphere, etc. We live in an truly extraordinary system, and to be born, to be members of this amazing community of life, is an unbelievable privilege. And the trouble is that we, in recent years, have moved away from that idea, and we're so busy trying to dominate and exploit and control and manage the planet instead of celebrating our participation in it and building mutually beneficial relationships that we've created all the problems that we have. And I think, unfortunately, we can't get out of them by tinkering and tweaking the system. We have to go back to the first principles and say we got it wrong at the beginning.
My guest is Cormac Cullinan, who's a practicing environmental attorney and author, and we're discussing Wild Law, his manifesto for Earth Justice on LNL, on RN. Now, you talk about reframing society for the 21st century. Reframe away, please, Cormac.
Well, I think the basic problem is similar to the one with apartheid, is we've set up a frame which says that we are separate, which is just factually incorrect. I mean, I think it's scientifically untenable. And we've conceived of our role as being to run the show. And at the same time, we haven't had the humility to accept that what we need to do is if we're part of this system, if we're part of this wider community, we have to play by its rules, which means we have to reframe our laws so that they are in sync or in line with the laws of the universe, of fundamental physical laws, etc. So right now, for example, almost everything that causes climate change is perfectly legal. There isn't a way of sort of ratcheting down our harmful activities as we approach these planetary boundaries. We define everything that isn't a human or a corporation as property, like we used to define people as slaves. It's very easy to see that there will always be an exploitative relationship between the slave owner, who has all the rights, and the slave who has none. And so we wonder why we've got problems through over-exploiting the Earth. It's because we've hardwired them in.
Now, we've got, you and I these days, somewhat mixed feelings about James Lovelock, but you are a wholehearted supporter of a Lovelockian, Thomas Berry, who wrote the foreword to your book's second edition. Tell us about this. I've been critical of theologians. This fellow is called a geologian.
Well, Thomas had a great sense of humour, and I think it was part of his way of escaping the pressures of the Catholic Church. He was obviously part of the church, and his views weren't wholly accepted within the church. But essentially, I think what he started off as a student of human history and comparative religion throughout the world. And I think he just expanded his time frames until he was working on geological time frames and saying that essentially that we need to look at this in those kind of time frames, because the transition that we're going through now is not something of historic significance on the scale of a couple of hundred years. It's on the scale of millions of years. We're changing the chemistry of the planet. This is a really, really fundamental shift.
Well, I hope he can drag a fair hunk of the church along with him, because much religious teaching is still that the world is here for us to exploit, as are all its critters.
Exactly. And there are in most religious traditions texts which contradict that, but I agree with you, that's the predominant way it's been interpreted. And the funny thing is, we're still fighting the same battles as Galileo. I'll give you an example. The church objected to Galileo and Copernicus, saying that the universe didn't revolve around the earth, and saying that in fact we revolved around the sun, the earth revolved around the sun. Not because they were worried about astronomy, but because that was the proof that we were the most important things in the universe. And right at the Rio conference earlier this year in June in Rio de Janeiro, 20th anniversary of the Earth Conference, we were working to get recognition of rights of nature language into the declaration. And you had the Holy See, you know, objecting to this kind of language, really, because there's a worry that it undermines the idea that human beings are superior on the planet.
You will never persuade our fellow creatures that that is not the case. It's a losing battle, Cormac. Why are we afraid of the idea that nature should have rights, just like humans have rights? I can well understand why bureaucrats would panic and why corporations would feel a bit miffed, but it also seems to disturb the psyches of many of our fellow citizens.
It does. I mean, I think at the base of it is fear. I mean, to use the white South African example, there was huge fear that if you gave the people whom you've been exploiting for all these years rights, that they would turn on you and they would, you would be at the receiving end. And in fact, there is no way forward to a healthy future other than embracing one's participation in the community and recognizing rights for all. And of course it would mean that some human activities which are currently undertaken could no longer be undertaken. But that's a very, very small price to pay for continued membership of the most beautiful planet in the system.
You might have been amused by a column I wrote last year, Cormac. I'm also a professional pundit for a broadsheet newspaper owned, would you believe, by Rupert Murdoch, and I was talking about modifying democracy into something called tree-mocracy and giving trees the vote. I think this is a big step forward.
Fantastic. Yes, it's what Vandana Shiva from India refers to as earth democracy, and certainly here in South Africa we're realizing that the democracy project, which resulted in the overthrow of apartheid, is not complete, because we need to expand democracy beyond just humans, because many of our most important relationships and the need for balance is not just between humans, but between us and the wider society. And of course, the human right to life is meaningless without water. Australia and South Africa are dry countries, and you can't guarantee there'll be water unless you guarantee the right to the river to flow, the forest to exist, and the mountain to exist.
Cormac Cullinan is my guest, and we're discussing earth polit-. Well, we're discussing extending the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man to the Rights of Mother Earth. Now, we were mentioning the Ecuadorian example, the Ecuadorian Constitution, as revised in 2008. What about the Rainbow Constitution? Have you had any effect or influence on South Africa?
I have drafted some laws for South Africa which have little bits and pieces in it, but I've drafted a document which I hope will be taken further. It draws its inspiration from two sources. It's called the People's Charter for Africa. The one source is the Universal Declaration of the Rights of, of Mother Earth, which led the drafting of, which came out of Bolivia. And the other is the Freedom Charter, which is was a seminal document in South African history. It was written by people in the 1950s. It was a widespread consultation movement. And it's an aspirational document imagining what a post-apartheid society would be. But crucially, it was imagined in the 50s when the height of oppression, it must have looked impossible that you could overthrow the system, but people imagined a future in which there was democracy.
I must assume that a great many fellow practitioners of the law in South Africa would regard you as stark raving nuts.
Yes, it's quite interesting. I have two very distinct hats that I wear. If clients come to see me, I advise them on environmental law as it is, and we're the oldest firm in the country doing that. But when I wear this particular hat, I'm talking about the law as I would like to see it. Depending on which hat I'm wearing when you meet me, you'll have a very different impression.
Well, of course, one of those two hats you were doffing when you helped draft the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth at the Alternative Climate Conference held in the wonderfully entitled Cochabamba. Tell us about that.
It was an extraordinary process. I'd been at the Copenhagen COP15 before and then went to Cochabamba, and the difference was quite amazing because there were 35,000 people there from around the world, and there would have been a lot more if there hadn't been the Icelandic volcano which stopped people getting there from Europe. But the big difference between the two is that Copenhagen is a nasty, bad-tempered horse trading business where everybody's trying to argue from national interest and nothing gets agreed. The other, Cochabamba, we had about 400 or 500 people in the room.
Cochabamba being in Bolivia.
In Bolivia, thank you. Yeah. All cooperating to try and find the right language to communicate these ideas to the rest of the world. So a much more cooperative process. National, the states that the people came from was not part of the discussion. Everybody stood up as citizens of the world and commented and put forward what they wanted to think.
Is it true that there were 35,000 people involved in the conference?
Yes, quite extraordinary. I mean, they didn't expect, I was expecting maybe 15 at top. So it was quite an extraordinary response, but the motivation was amazing. I mean, just to share one brief story, at the end, the document had been drafted and it was put to a plenary group and everybody could come up and speak. And this lovely old woman with a nut brown face and long white hair in a traditional dress came to the microphone and she said, "I've read this document and there's something wrong with it, there's something missing. Nowhere does it talk about love and why we look after Mother Earth because we love her. That's what it's about." And she was dead right. I mean, if she'd said it earlier, it probably would have been in the document. But the difference of the motivation between the mainstream view, which is about how far we can exploit Earth, how many parts per million we can go to before it all collapses, and the people's view from Cochabamba of connection and essentially love, was extraordinary.
I'm not sure that my friend Peter Singer uses the word love much, but as you well know, he's been trying to extend the legal rights of animals.
Yes, I'm going to be participating in a conference this weekend, the Festival of Dangerous Ideas, and then the following weekend up at Southern Cross University, we will be talking about the difference between animal rights and this approach. I think they're broadly speaking compatible, but they come from a different starting point, I think.
Well, what about the range, the rights of nature? If a wolf eats a deer, does it infringe the deer's rights?
It's one of those things where actually part of the role of the deer is to be eaten, sadly. So at the micro level, it could be said to infringe the rights of the deer, but it wouldn't be against Earth jurisprudence, it wouldn't be against the system, because the greater good is served by wolves eating deers. So one really has to look at, it's an approach which says that the preservation of the whole, which is the body within which we all live, must take precedence over the individual rights.
And I would suspect that you've come across similar concepts in African customary law.
Absolutely. It's quite extraordinary about how throughout the world customary legal systems find ways of dealing with these issues. And the big difference, of course, is that they regard the universe as animate, that you have to negotiate your relationship with animals, with trees, with rivers, with sacred places. And they tried to do that, and the answers that societies come up with around the world are different, but they all serve the purpose.
There are certainly concepts like this within Australian indigenous communities, and just up the road in Bali, which is, as you know, is a remnant Hindu society. There's also a passionate animism, which sees life in rocks, life or spirit, if you like, in trees. It's so many, many ancient cultures do try to deal with this, and what you're trying to do is get modern 21st century cultures to get in line.
And the reason is quite simply is that the current period is the aberration. If you look at it through the vast sweep of human history, for the majority of human history, we have understood ourselves as part of and dependent on this greater whole, and that our survival depends on maintaining good relationships with nature and understanding the rules of nature. So actually we're in an aberrant period right now, and I'm saying that this is not an ascientific approach, it's not an irrational approach, it's recognizing that our models are very inaccurate, and science shows that, and we need to go back to models which emphasize that what's important is relatedness and relationships. That's what we've got to get right.
Well, it won't be easy, as you well know. I mean, the intensity, the ferocity of climate change denialism shows that many people will go right to the edge of the cliff on ideological ground.
That's right. I mean, you're quite right. And quite frankly, the jury's still out, I think, as to whether or not we're going to be able to turn this around before many, many, many millions die of humans. But I can't get out of bed on a Monday morning thinking that it's all finished. And I have a huge belief in the ingenuity of humankind to solve problems.
You're a funny fellow, Cormac. You're a sunny optimist. Cormac Cullinan, environmental attorney, author of Wild Law, a manifesto for Earth Justice, is also, as you can hear, a very, very amiable fella. The book is published by Chelsea Green Publishing, and the Festival of Dangerous Ideas is on at the Sydney Opera House from the 28th until the 30th of September. And yes, we will put a link to that on our website, abc.net.au/radio national, and you follow the links to Late Night Live. On our next, guess what? I'll be talking to Bruce Shapiro with his weekly dose of all things American, up to and including Obama's drones. And we'll spend the rest of the program talking about the actor Richard Burton with Chris Williams, who edited his diaries. Oh, and Sally Burton, who was married to him for a little over 2 years. I'm not sure whether that was before or after Elizabeth. Stick around on RN for the news, and we will see you later.